Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right. Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us for, as always, the most scintillating hour in finance radio. And what a week. Got a lot going on here. Plenty to talk about. And then also another special guest with us today. Going to have an economic discussion, the state of affairs, of things going on in the global economy. Currency prices, all of that good stuff with a great guy, Tony Greer of TG Macro Research. If you don't know the name, he's a frequent contributor, I guess you'd call it, to Real Vision, macroeconomic / financing channel. And I've said this before, but if you're a hardcore finance nerd like I am, and, a real economic enthusiast, check out realvision.com. They've got a free trial. They've just got some great content in there. And we're not listening to talking heads. We're not listening to people talk their own book. These are guys that actually run money, some of the best money managers in the world. And I can't recommend enough. But anyway, you can find Tony on there. And Tony fits our bill. He's just a really smart guy with great and very deep knowledge in the industry. Been doing this for a long time. And he's also plain spoken. He's not trying to sound erudite and too cool for school. And because you get a lot of that in finance, you get a lot of guys that just want to sound the part, it always frustrates me because I'm sitting there going, hey, if you really understand something, you should be able to break it down in very plain English. You should be able to break it down to, explain it to a 5-year-old. And if you can't quickly explain in plain language or in plain English what you're trying to say, you probably don't have that great of an understanding. Anyway, Tony fits that bill 100%, and I think you guys will really enjoy hearing his outlook on things. The other thing I appreciate about Tony is that he does not get too in the weeds as far as, look, this thing's going down or this thing's going up. He's got a trader background, and we're not traders. We're investors. It's a different ballgame. But even in investing, I think it's so important to have that outlook. And you guys know, listening to the show, we've been concerned for a really long time. And I get asked all the time by people, Zach, you've been worried about markets for so long. How have you hung in there? It hasn't happened or you're wrong. When are you going to admit you're wrong? And I go, well, what way? And they go, well, you've been missing out. And I go, well, no, we haven't. We've been invested. Just because we've got concerns, we're not, again, like I've told you guys, we're not timing markets. But when you're managing other people's money like we are, you've got to be cognizant of these things, especially in the world that we live in. And the thing that I find fascinating is when we get into bull markets like this, and I'm hearing it every day, right? I say, hey, and I've been saying it, longest bull market in U.S. history. On 9 out of 10 different metrics, it's the most expensive stock market in U.S. history. And the longer it goes on, the more and more bulletproof people sound. And if you just step back and look at it, that's wrong. Because no matter how you want to paint it, every day we continue on is a day closer to another nasty market event. But you see that dynamic on both sides. The guys get too bared up. Oh, everything's going to hell in a handbasket. Sell all your stocks. And thank God that that hasn't been the approach that we've taken. Because look what's happened, right? And that's when we talk about lowering risk exposure and all that other kind of stuff. I just think it's, and we've said it many times, I just think it's very important to point out, do not try to time markets. I don't. That's not what we look at. We adjust to market realities. We adjust to protect principal. We don't just sit there and watch our, and look, this is what a lot of people do. That's, and I get it. But if a client is paying us a fee to look out for their money, my answer to them all the time isn't going to be, well, we just ride it up. And if that's your answer, and again, I'm not denigrating that. I grew up in that environment, I started my career in that environment. And I also know through experience and data and research, we cannot time markets. Yet, I also know that there are times to be more aggressive and there are times to be less aggressive. And so in no way have we been advocating. I've never said that people should sell their stocks. I want to point that out because you cannot time markets. And I'll tell you firsthand, I think we were on the radio. When that last dip happened, I don't think we were actually. In 2015, 2016, oil imploded and it really looked like we were going into recession. I really thought we were going to start a recession. I really thought ugly markets were in front of us. Now, luckily enough, we had prepared for that. We had become more defensive during that period of time. But even though that was our outlook, we didn't sell everything because you can't time markets. And if you're sitting at home and you think you can, A, you haven't been doing it. Right? A, I don't think you've done it before. You haven't actually tried to manage money or invest your own money. But B, just don't try to do it. That being said, let's also not go to the other extreme side of it and just act, it just cracks me up. Everybody's a buy and hold investor forever at the top of bull markets. And then those same people are running and screaming, 16 months later when everything's falling apart. So we can't be on either extreme. And if you want a perfect example, just look at the last 20 years. Two different occasions the last 20 years, you got cut in half. And there are certainly fears and big concerns we've got right now, mainly valuation. Because I think we get too caught up in what direction things are going rather than paying attention to the valuation. And that's one of the reasons why we like a mixed approach, meaning that we've got ETF portfolios that we use that give our clients broad exposure to the market because we never know what's going to happen. And I think that's important. But we also have a more strategic tactical approach where we're picking individual stocks that we believe have taken a beating and they're trading under value. And I think that there's room for both of those. I hear all these conflicting arguments all the time about, oh, no, this is better and that's better. Pick your period of time. We can go back and forth all day long when a more tactical value-based approach works, when a more momentum, general exposure to the market. Okay, so let's not try to be one or the other. How about a blended approach, right? And then the other thing that we're doing too, like I've said a million times, is the bond side of it. The bond market gives us a much higher level of clarity and certainty than the stock market does. If interest rates go up, bonds lose value. If interest rates go down, they gain value. Why are we not nuts about bonds right now? For the same reason we haven't been since I've been on the show. Because interest rates can't go down very much. And that means that the value we're going to get from bonds is really the interest they're paying us, which is virtually nothing. So we got a lot of downside, very little upside. That's not a good investment setup. So what have we done? Why do we own bonds? For security, safety, right? Well, what if we had a portfolio that was geared toward the stock market that was also insured against loss, couldn't lose, also had no management fees, and it's average, again, we don't want to get into performance just because past performance is no guarantee of future results, but these types of products that are giving you 50% upside in the stock market have typically averaged somewhere between 5% as high as 7% in that range, right? Well, if we can average somewhere, but even let's call it even 4 to 6.5% a year with zero risk, and no cap on our potential. So if you have a year where the market goes up 30%, you can make double digits. All the while, you're insured against loss. So you're safer than bonds. You're not paying a management fee like you are with bonds. And you're capturing 50 to 60% of the upside of the momentum of the stock market. Guys, it's the biggest no-brainer in investing. And if you listen to the show, you're probably tired of hearing about it. But anyway, if this is the type of insight you want, if you don't want to pay somebody just to sit there and watch your mutual funds like you are, you want to pay for somebody that's going to take active roles and try to protect capital in bad times and deploy more capital when prices are low and, you know, have a more active approach that's trying to give you a better result than you could get sitting in mutual funds yourself, give us a call. We're probably a good fit. And you can get us at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. And I will say this as a blanket statement. Everybody can benefit from that bond replacement strategy we're talking about. When you can get safer, spend less in fees, and get more upside, the answer is yes. Now, you may have questions about whether that's really the case. And if you do, call us. 866-779-RISK. I'm not going to put you in some weird sales process and try to convince you. We just show you the data. Hey, here it is. Look, this is real. This is not a flash in the pan. This is not snake oil. And if you don't believe me, go listen to the episode we did with Roger Ibbotson, Dr. Roger Ibbotson of Yale. So anyway, if you want to get a hold of us, and if you don't want to call us, you can just email us. Go to knowyourriskradio.com or go to bulwarkcapitalmgmt.com. Google Know Your Risk Radio. Sign up for the podcast. Sign up for the newsletter. Anyway, you guys know how to get a hold of us. But got a great guest on, Tony Greer, coming right up after the break. Hope you enjoy the show. And as always, we'll see you again next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
A lot of people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than what would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay your estate back with interest if you never use it. But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your kids have to do is carry out your wishes. You're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice my wife and I got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian has an asset-based class Saturday, August 17th in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering self-funding long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that is not the best idea. Seating will be limited for this special asset-based class, August 17th in Bellevue. Reserve your spot right now, 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com.
We've all heard the term buy low and sell high, and markets have recently hit another all-time high. And that begs the question, is this the top? Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Is this the top? No one knows. The truth is, we no longer need to know. By using our risk-managed stock portfolios and Bulwark's bond replacement strategy, we can lower your fees, increase your upside, and drastically reduce your risk exposure. This is now the longest bull market in U.S. financial history, and stock valuations have never been higher. So why risk it? Call now to get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement in place where the firm is licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us and welcome back to the show. And lucky enough, we've had a good run lately, Darren, a great run of guests. And this guy is no different. Guy that I've been following for quite some time. The proprietor, if you will, of TG Macro. And somebody that is on Real Vision. He's been all over the place and got some really interesting takes on the macroeconomic side. And anyway, without further ado, Tony Greer, thank you so much for joining us, and we're really pumped to have you on the show.
Hey, Zach, thanks for having me, man. It's great to speak cross country about markets.
Yeah, well, and this conversation, I know that our listeners can appreciate this. This conversation was supposed to start about a half hour ago, but thanks to seafare traffic and some wrecks. And it's funny, Tony, I know you'll get a kick out of this, right? You say Seattle, And everybody immediately thinks rain, right? I mean,
yeah,
right. Well, when you live here, the minute a drop of rain falls, everybody just flips out. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing where you're just sitting there going, guys, this is Seattle for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Just mayhem. But anyway, okay, so Tony, before we get into this, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was, A, I love your take on stuff. B, the guys that we really try to get on and that we like to talk to are guys that can tackle really complex issues and break them down in layman's terms, where everything isn't so esoteric and highbrow. You know, I feel like we got a lot of that in finance, right? I love to talk to the real practitioners, the real guys that aren't trying to sound all erudite and, you know, sophisticated, that can we can talk about it in plain language. And I've been impressed with you on that level. And then the other reason why, you do a lot of deep macro research, but you're one of the only guys I know that does macro research that has a deep trading background. That's the other, you know what I mean? I joke around with some other my buddies that run portfolios, and you know, you kind of separate the world of researchers and actual managers, and you straddle both those lines. Can you give us a story of your career and you know, what got you to where you are and kind of your background and how you got your start in this business?
Yeah, sure, Zach. I came out of college at Cornell University determined to get a job on a trading desk because I am the son of a 30-year over-the-counter trader, my dad. So, you know, trading conversation was dinner table conversation from the time that I was a kid, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So to cut to the chase, you know, I worked at UBS and got a start at Sumitomo Bank, actually, for 2 years on the FX desk. Then I went to UBS for 2 years. Then I wound up joining Goldman Sachs, the J. Aaron division, which is their commodity trading division. And that was like joining the Yankees for me in terms of becoming a real trader. I really learned everything that I know about trading, about rigor, about how to apply, you know, narratives to storylines, to markets, and then get to the end game, which is actually making money out of nothing, right?
Yeah.
So you learn at Goldman Sachs at the J. Aaron division when you're managing the commodity space there. You know, you learn about physical markets. You learn everything about the futures markets. You learn how to follow, you know, the merchants in the business and understand really what's the underlying movements of commodity markets are all about. And I really just basically I apply that to the trading that I do today. I left Goldman Sachs in 2000 after the IPO and tried trading on my own for a year and a half. And it was exciting. And I started off pretty basically really well and then got into just basically a churn for a long time. And I decided to go on to the sales side from there. So that's where I spent about 10 years after that on the sell side. And after jumping back and forth from a couple of shops, after having a great run at one shop, I decided to stop playing pickup basketball with my career and just go out on my own and apply everything that I've learned to, you know, helping people make money in markets. And that was basically, you know, that's the genesis of where I am now. I guess the important thing is that throughout the entire time I have been writing about markets on a daily basis for my own, you know, for my own notes and for learning about, for being a student of the market. And that turned into a daily note that I sent to my equity clients, which turned into the Morning Navigator, the newsletter that I'm the editor of and publish every single day. So that's where I am now, man. Does that catch me up?
Yeah. And that's a lot of writing. You're putting that out every single day, right?
Yeah.
What does that process look like? You know, what kind of wake up time are we looking at? Do you do it at night? I mean, what does that process look like? I'm fascinated by that because that's a ton of work.
Wow. That's cool that you recognize that because it is a lot of work, man. You know, it's very much modeled like a trading week, right? Like when I learned that trading weeks at Goldman Sachs, actually, I learned that, you know, your trading week starts on Sunday night, right? And that's when you look at the Tokyo markets opening and you see how markets are trading in that zone and you watch price action and, you know, you carry that right through five sessions and the close is really just one weekly close on Friday when you finally get to catch your breath. So that is how the application of my newsletter, I try to keep it the same way as I apply it to my trading. And you're basically, I set up a curriculum for the week of comments I want to touch on or news items that are coming out that I'm going to want to talk about. And then it's really, it's a combination between setting up my curriculum and then talking about the positions that I put on in my newsletter. That's really what takes up the bulk of my content. But putting it out every day is a discipline that I force myself to have, because it forces you to vet out, what's really important in the market on any given day.
Yeah, we do see, here's one of the reasons I asked this question. We do, or are attempting to do, a weekly roundup email for our clients, just explaining, you know, what's going on in the markets and the economies in general. And, managing the accounts, dealing with the clients, all the other stuff. It is so hard to stay on that regular schedule, just because there's life coming at you. And, doing it every single day. I realize what a Herculean effort that is, and I think you use the word discipline.
I decided to make that and trading 100% of what I do. That was when I had to rip the Band-Aid off when I left the broker-dealer side as an equity sales trader, and decided that I just didn't want to battle electronics anymore. And it was really about saying, okay, I was going to have this discipline every day.
Gotcha.
And that's how the whole thing comes about.
Okay, now one of the other things I love is that it's funny to me to have a discussion about macroeconomics, because much the same way, I grew up at a house where my dad was running the BD, and they were a broker dealer, but they specialized mostly in natural resource space. A lot of OTC stuff. So there's similarities there. Investing and trading and commodities and economics, that was just part of the family discussions, just part of the game. A big part of that for me, again, growing up, was that macroeconomic backdrop, understanding what's making things move in the world. When I actually got out into the finance space, I was shocked to realize that that's not the normal approach, that a lot of people aren't looking at the macroeconomic picture. I feel like a lot of times it gets treated almost like, voodoo or witchcraft. Oh, you're one of those macro guys, And I can't imagine not being a student of that. One, I just think it's endlessly fascinating. But I kind of feel like it's almost like a short seller. Like, macroeconomic guys are born, right? They're not made. What got you? You must have an intense interest in this stuff. What got you on the macroeconomic side? How did that evolve?
To be honest with you, the first event literally that shook me from being, I would say, a literal pedestrian sort of coming out of college to saying, okay, I need to learn what the hell is going on here, was when I was in the Sumitomo trading room on the 107th floor of One World Trade Center, and George Soros, the Quantum Fund, was trying to break the British pound. And you would listen, you would listen to, in an FX dealing room back then, everything was a voice broker.
Yeah.
And, you would have to plug into their line. You had a direct line to all of them. You plugged into their line to speak to them. But you literally had six broker boxes on your desk, all quoting different prices in the same currency cross. But all of the prices were bid offers that were correct bid offers. For example, in cable, the bid offer would be, 1.15, 50 bid at 75. Just to quote a large spread. But what was amazing, the day that I heard the broker quoting the Soros side of the trade versus the Bank of England side of the trade, I'll never forget the price. It was the price of cable quoted over the box was 178.80 bid Bank of England, 178.78 offered Quantum Fund. So the price was inverted, with the Quantum Fund trying to get you to buy all the pounds that they could from you through the Bank of England's peg, knowing that they were going to have to devalue. And I'm sitting there saying, what is going on here, man? This is insane. And then he broke it and the thing tumbled and I was addicted, and that's it.
Yeah. Then you get hooked, right?
That's it.
Down the rabbit hole you go.
You start calculating how much money he made, and that gets you excited.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. So without further ado, then I would get into it. I was kind of licking my chops looking at this, because I really didn't, you know, you and I didn't even discuss this. There was no timing aspect. But coming into this week, realizing that, holy smokes, we got Tony on the show on Friday. I think we're going to have a lot to talk about. I didn't think we'd have quite this much. But let's start right in your wheelhouse. Let's start on an economic discussion. And to have an understanding, we're talking, this show's disseminated out on public radio in the Seattle area. So, you know, the vast majority of our listeners are retail investors or people that just got stuck in the car with this radio station on. So, and the big, and we have this discussion with our clients all the time. I think there's a big separation between what the average folks out there think is actually going on in the world and then what, you know, you and I know is going on. Kind of give us a backdrop.
Great,
you know,
point.
You don't have to get too granular, but kind of just give us a backdrop of where we are in a macroeconomic sense and the things that you're really watching with a U.S., you know, with attention paid to the U.S., but also the globe.
Yeah, you know, that's a great way to look at it. It is very much a global picture now, and Zach, now more than ever, especially since we're coming out of a pretty strict decade of globalism type of economics. So what's going on now, the way I look at it, is I try to keep my eye on the biggest economies in the world and know what's going on over there, right? That's the short story, right? So I want to keep an eye on the U.S., on China, on Japan, and on Europe. And if I know that, you know, we're from starting point, you know, of the U.S. Economy running at 2.1% annual growth of GDP and China running at something like 6% GDP down from 8%, at least you have a starting point.
Yeah.
Right? You have a starting point to say, okay, this is these are two engines here, and I can see sort of how hard they're firing. Right. So, you know, you want to keep an eye. It's important to keep an eye on China as one of the largest economies on the planet and growing, you know, because that's the engine that's pushing global growth. Right. You have to keep an eye on the U.S. because we're basically in the lead in terms of having the reserve currency and the most popular treasury bills and everything like that. So, you know, from the GDP, you start getting into where are interest rates in these respective countries. Right. And that's how you'll get another way of sort of comparing apples to apples. You know, so, for example, I rarely take my eye off of, you know, U.S. obviously the U.S. Treasury curve. But to just peg it somewhere, let's look at the 10-year yield at, you know, which just went through 2% yesterday to I think it's around 185 right now. I can call it up. Hang on.
Yeah,
it's around. So the U.S. 10-year yield is 185. And then, for example, the German 10-year yield is minus 50 basis points. Right. So you can see the differences in, you know, U.S. versus European credit markets and start to understand what's going on. Then you've got to get the central bank picture together. And what we've got going on right now is all central banks have just pivoted to a more dovish stance, which is an easier money stance. And that is to combat the slowdown in the manufacturing economy that has been caused by President Trump assessing tariffs on China. And that's the short story, if I can, you know, if I had to encapsulate it, but we can go from here.
Yeah, well, and that's what I wanted to get on with you, to kind of take the discussion in that direction, because you're on Real Vision all the time. You're doing pieces on there, and I love them. I love the stuff. Love the guys that you get on there and chat with. And
thank you.
There's been, you know, we had Recession Week where you know, Raul did a bunch of deep dives and really looking at. You know, the whole global economy and looking at, you know, are we going into a recession? And I wanted to get your take on that. Where do you think we're at in this cycle? Where do you think we are at economically? What do you think is currently going on? And what is the trajectory that you are seeing us on? And where do you think that we're headed right now?
Yeah, well, you know, I try not to, Zach, this is funny, as a trader, I try not to think about where we're going.
Right.
I try to look at it and say, this is what we've got.
Right.
You know, and so if I had to look at it that way, I would say that, you know, the U.S. was absolutely firing post-Trump election. You know, what happened was we had the manufacturing sector and consumer confidence simultaneously take off. So that was interesting to watch, and it drove markets for quite a while. And then what happened was Trump came out at the beginning of this year with the tariff game, and that slowed everything down. So we've got to keep an eye on U.S. PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, which is a really good indicator of manufacturing expansion or slowdown. And to break it down, basically the Mason-Dixon line is 50, reading of 50, right?
Yep.
I mean, reading north of 50 means we're expanding. Read south of it means we're contracting.
Yep.
So we've fallen now, our manufacturing PMI has fallen now from high 50s to the low 50s. So we're borderline contracting. We have seen the PMIs of European countries all go into contraction, essentially. China has gone into moderate contraction. And so we have to see what happens now. But industry has clearly slowed down around the world. What hasn't changed at all is consumer confidence. The consumer is still exceedingly confident. We just got conference board numbers yesterday. We just got University of Michigan confidence. We are at the highs of this move. So as long as the retail investor is still confident, we have the sort of offset to that manufacturing weakness because the consumer is the huge part of the economy. And that's what's sort of keeping things balanced right now. But I do think that we're at some risk. Obviously, these trade tariffs are a leveling of the playing field, and they are going to matter. And so, you know, if we have to pay up a little bit to get there, I think it'll probably be worth it, to be honest with you.
Couldn't agree with you more. I was actually on a podcast with Tobias Carlyle. You know Toby?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I was on his show, and we talked about tariffs specifically, and my whole thing was it's been a fascinating conversation for me because people, you know, the anti-tariff guys come out and say, well, it hurts economic growth. And you look at them and go, well, yeah, I don't think anybody's are. I mean, maybe Trump believes, I don't really know, but I don't know any serious person that thinks that tariffs aren't harmful to economic growth.
Right.
I mean, of course they are. The question is it a price worth paying? And I guess the way I look at the tariff is we're going to pay the cost of the tariff one way or another. And I'd rather have this showdown on the ground that we choose at the time we choose, especially when we're still a bigger economy. Is that similar to your take?
Yeah, it's very similar to my take. I totally agree 100% on what you said. I also, I add in the caveat that we just came out of, you know, essentially look at, you know, 2008 to 2016 during the Obama administration was sort of peak globalism, right? And what that meant was that China was picking our pocket on global trade, and that costs you, right? That costs our country. And, you know, the headline that you can bash Trump about is the trade tariffs and they damage the stock market. And it's like, well, look up at the stock market. We're still at the all-time highs. But the reality is that it cost us a lot of jobs, right? Because, they said that the labor would come cheaper in China. And so that's what corporate America did. They sent the factories over there. And so that was a huge problem for the country. It caused, you know, what it likely partially contributed to the major opioid crisis in this country. And I don't mean to get too socioeconomic on you, but I feel like those things have to be considered when you consider why Trump is doing this. You know, I think that he's aware of what's happened. And I think that his number one thing is to bring jobs back to the United States. And the only way to do that is to take China out of the center of the equation and at least not let them be in charge and have, you know, a gigantic trade deficit, a trade surplus with the U.S. that they pay no tax on.
Right. Right. No,
you know?
Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying the reality of that is that that was completely outrageous. And if the media would have covered it as such, then the world would have been like, oh, I see why we're putting tariffs on them now to level the playing field. Nobody was complaining when China was picking our pocket with no tariffs on, you know, a $6 billion trade surplus or whatever the number is with us. A $6 trillion surplus with us.
Yeah, it's been a very bizarre, I get it. I get that Trump is a very polarizing figure. Like I said, we've joked around before on the show that he may have the worst bedside manner of anybody in public office, right? I get all that, but it's like people just get so focused that anything the guy does, it's horrible. And you look at him and the whole China, I mean, like you said, I think it's a great way to put it, pick in our pocket in so many ways.
Yep.
And that connection to the opioid crisis, I mean, you just see there's straight lines. I mean, this isn't tinfoil conspiracy type stuff, you know.
It's not.
And you know, the other aspect of it too is the ongoing, you know, what are we, somewhere like $300 billion the estimate is of IP theft per year, and then the way that they are, you know, they want the fair trade argument just boils my blood, because what their definition of is give them unfettered access to our markets, and yet we've got to dance and grow, you know, we got to play all their games on their side. And I look at them and go, if you like fair trade, then you should love the tariffs. And they give you this kind of ridiculous look, but you go, hey guys, it's more fair than it's been at any time in the last 25 years.
You make a great point, Zach. You make a great point. I love it.
Yeah, it's
spot on.
It's been fascinating to me. Now, you said something earlier that I'd really like to hear your take on, that we looked at it, and it really looks to me like China really started slowing at the end of 2016 before the tariffs came into play. What do you make of that? And now everybody's attributing it, right? This is the tariff global slowdown. It really looks like that was starting to happen prior to the tariffs. Do you have any thoughts on that? Did you notice that? Have you observed that same thing?
You know, I did notice that they had slowed down off of their sort of firing, you know, what were they, 8.5% peak, you know, GDP or something like that. So they were definitely cooling off, and that was due to, you know, the banks had to restrict lending just a little bit because they're on pace for another year of record defaults.
Right? they're reporting.
Right. That they're just the ones that they're reporting. Exactly.
Right.
So that, you know, I mean, you know, the thing with China, Zach, we just have to take it at face value, or else we have to make that comment every single time we mention China data. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We have to throw the asterisk in there. So all we can do is take it at face value.
Rate of change.
The market is going to trade off, right?
Yep. Yeah, I know. I totally agree. I have called into question the quality or the integrity of their data on multiple occasions. And then in that same argument, or in another economic argument, I'll hear myself quoting their rate of growth. And just some incongruency there I've found in my own arguments, where I'm like, wait a second. You can't sit there and say the data is incorrect and then start throwing it out in another part of your own argument, you know?
Exactly.
We like you said, we got to play the world as we see it, and that's the nature of it. So
I'm with you. I'll say the data comes out and I will sit here and flat out not believe it, but the market is trading off of it anyway.
Yeah. Well, and then that's the beautiful unique aspect of this market, right? Like Buffett says, on a day-to-day basis, the market's a drunken psychopath, and that's true all times. But look at the run-up we've had, Tony, so far this year, based on the idea of a trade deal. You know, I don't have contacts in the State Department, but these people that think a trade deal is right around, I don't see it. I don't think it's close at all. I don't think it has been close. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree with you 100%. I was saying that the whole time most traders that paid attention to that feedback loop that you just mentioned, whereby every time they mentioned that there might have been dialogue, the market would rally, right? So we're not even talking about resolution. We're talking about 25, 30-point S&P rallies on the mention of potential dialogue. You know, that's when you know that there's something going on, right? Like, it makes no sense that there would be a resolution happening anytime soon, but the market is acting like it is. So I totally agree with you that China is playing a long game with us. We're you know, Trump obviously put the pressure on the Federal Reserve to ease, and ease big, because he was ready to come back at them with more tariffs because he wasn't happy with their timetable.
Yeah.
Right. So here we've got Trump trying to force the issue. And I don't think that they would do that. And he's making it more difficult by putting more tariffs on them. Right. So we're going to eventually come to a head, but I don't think it's anytime soon. Like, I don't think it's going to be any time before the 2020 election. And that's really the only data point that matters. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a one horse town as far as that data point goes.
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, to me, it's either he solves it before the election or he doesn't. Right. And so I got a feeling that he maybe is putting pressure on them. So maybe he can deliver a resolution for the election. You know, in order to get there, he's got to start getting a move on now. But I don't know. That's pure speculation. And it could go through the election. But I don't think it's generally going to hurt him.
Well, the
economy is still in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think is really interesting to think about is – If you put yourself in China's shoes, and again, it goes back to the conversation I was having with Toby. There's a part of me that feels, now we're speculating, obviously, and we're doing it because it's fun. At least for me, yeah. Just talk about the theoreticals and what could happen. But if you try to really take a step back and look at it from, at least from my perspective, I almost feel like if China comes to the table, that is going to worry me more about the internal state of their economy, because I don't think they can play it straight. I don't think that they can keep on their rate of growth or their current, you know, the current setup in the Chinese economy. I just don't think it can continue if they are playing it straight. Not playing it straight has just been way too much of a boon for them. So I'm looking at it going, man, I think if they come to the table, that I might be more concerned. And the flip side is, if you're in China's shoes, wouldn't you just sit back and wait to see who wins the next election? I mean, you know, unless you are forced to do a deal because things are about to unravel, what upside do you have of trying to get a deal done with Trump? You know, whatever it's going to be way tougher than whoever takes office next.
Yeah, I don't know, though. I don't think if you're China, I don't think you want another 4 years of economic agony. You can't risk that. You know, you can't risk, you know, sitting back and see who takes office next is a crazy idea if the record has shown that when the economy is strong and the markets are strong, the president gets a second term. Right. So, I mean, this is they would be betting against history and against math to say, oh, you know what, let's just wait until 2020. Maybe this guy's gone and we get it off our back. I don't think there's a chance of that. I mean, there is a chance, but I don't think that's a likely or safe thing to bet on for China, because if it's another 4 or 5 years of this, or 2 or 3 years of this even, their GDP growth might be down to nothing. And that won't be good for the global economy either. So, you know, everybody's got to be careful with what they're wishing for here. But I would agree with you that if China came to the table, it would mean something really significant, meaning like, you know, I would sort of read it as, okay, that's it. That's uncle. And we need to get, you know, Trump off our back somehow and figure out a solution to this tariff and make a deal and say, we'll pay you for this. We won't pay you for this, and see where it gets us. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Know, it's very difficult to speculate. You know, I try to take it day by day and see what the market gives us.
Yeah. No. And that's a sane, rational, sober way to look at it. So we got to take a quick break, but you brought up currency trading, and I'm glad you did, because that's the next thing I want to get into. So stick with us through the break. We'll come right back and we'll get into the currency side of it and get your take on that.
I'm here, man.
All right, pal. All right, guys. Well, hey, once again, listening to Tony Greer, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high cost of an extended healthcare situation. A lot of people assume they have enough money saved only to watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Don't make this mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you won't become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn all about the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay your estate back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott, who's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. Their classes coming up in August on Saturday the 17th and Monday the 19th. Seating is limited, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. Classes are free, and you'll even get a copy of Brian's book. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
We've all heard the term buy low and sell high, and markets have recently hit another all-time high. And that begs the question, is this the top? Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Is this the top? No one knows. The truth is, we no longer need to know. By using our risk-managed stock portfolios and Bulwark's bond replacement strategy, we can lower your fees, increase your upside, and drastically reduce your risk exposure.
This is now the longest bull market in U.S. financial history, and stock valuations have never been higher. So why risk it? Call now to get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement in place where the firm is licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And as a reminder, we are lucky enough to be joined by Tony Greer of TG Macro. He is a professional trader and runs a research firm. And you're supplying research mostly to RIAs or a lot of, you know, what, small family offices, that kind of stuff?
I have a really wide variety of clients that I have, Zach. It's really a great it's one of the things that I've loved about leaving the broker-dealer side and having only a hedge fund or a mutual fund as a client. You know, now since I've gone off on my own, I have a sort of level of portfolio manager clients. I have a level of sort of execution desk trader clients that are, you know, in the hedge fund and mutual fund side. And then I have a ton of wealth advisors that have been latching on to my note for idea generation. And then I've got a lot of just individual traders. I've got RIAs. I would say that I am probably about 20 to 25% wealth advisors, which is a pretty cool bulk to have. They're a great client base. They're some of them are family offices, like you mentioned, and they're all great people to work with.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So getting into the, it sounded to me like when you were talking about your history that FX trading, currency trading is near and dear to your heart. Was that a correct assessment?
Yes, sir. That's where I started. Those are my original roots.
Okay, so I'd be remiss if we didn't get into a dollar discussion. Where is the dollar headed? I haven't even looked at DXY this morning. Where are we at right now? Do you know?
Yeah, I'll tell you where we are, and I'll tell you. I can give you my assessment in a sort of nutshell. Right, we are now at 98 in the dollar index. Right.
Yep.
That puts us at the top end of the sort of 96, 98 range. I could argue that we've been in all year, right?
Yep.
Then I can tell you that that range is at the epicenter of the sort of 88 to 105 range that we've been in for, call it, the last 5 years.
Yep.
And my view on the dollar is that I am a terminal king dollar bull.
Gotcha.
Right, I posture myself as a dollar bull because rationally, it is still the best center to invest and probably the safest center for your dollar. So it's going to have that premium attached to it. So that's why I just stay bullish the dollar. I stay out of the existential arguments that take place on FinTwit about the dollar as reserve currency, because I believe firmly that it is going to retain its status and that's not going to change, and just sort of play the dollar from a neutral side, because the reality is all of the central banks are currently easing and diluting their currency in some fashion. So it seems to me like it's a coordinated currency dilution and the dollar is the sort of shock absorber in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's how I look at it. You know, like the euro was, you know, remained firm against the dollar for a little while, and now the dollar's strong and it's backed off. But you've got cable coming apart because of the no-deal Brexit potential of Boris Yeltsin. And then you've got some other currencies. You know, you've got the yuan coming apart this morning because Trump is, you know, establishing another level of tariffs. So there's another level of uncertainty there. So we've got a three sigma slide in the Chinese yuan. That's a huge move. And so these are the sort of things that are all moving against the dollar while the dollar is sitting here right in the middle of its range. So I try not to lend too much weight to the dollar position or price and just sort of maintain a pretty bullish posture toward it. You know, if it broke below 95, I may get a little bit concerned that we may go to the bottom of the wider range. If it broke 100, I may get concerned that we may go to the top of the wider range. But I still think the dollar is going to remain in a super tight range with the central bank behavior that we're seeing.
Gotcha. Okay, so what do you... Again, getting into your philosophy and your look at things, if you think the dollar, if you're a dollar bull right now, would that intimate that you are leaning more toward continued economic hardship, maybe more contraction abroad? Is that part of that dollar bull outlook?
The dollar does act as a wrecking ball sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? So the dollar can rally and, you know, for example, you know, take the Turkish lira apart, you know, and you see things like that, and you'll see it really, really weigh on emerging markets, right? And on occasion, it'll rock the peso and things like that. So, you know, the dollar does act like a wrecking ball, especially to emerging markets, because they're the most fragile and there's the first place that capital runs from, right? There's always a capital suck back when there's an event that takes place in an emerging market. I do think that there are, there are other moves out there that you definitely have to monitor, because the dollar does tend to do some damage when it gets firm. But it seems like the other currencies are all kind of taking their turn doing these little tumbles against the dollar. And the reality is the only one that matters right now, in my opinion, is the yuan and the Indian rupee. You know, because those are the two big drivers of the energy market right there, China and India. And so, you know, I just want to keep a close eye on those currencies to make sure that they don't get, you know, too severely weak to a point that their central banks have to interact, you know, because that could be read as a sign of weakness, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just some things to keep in mind with the global balance there.
Okay, so now on the yuan, while this as much for my edification as it is for the listeners, because I have never traded FX, not once, never done an FX trade. I mean, I've done trades based on currency movements, but, you know, not something that we do on the, you know, for our clients for a variety of different reasons. I feel like if you haven't spent a substantial amount of time like you have being in that world, and especially on the institutional side and sitting on a desk, I just think you're at a horrible disadvantage in that world. But so I'm a bit of novice on the currency side of it, but I've been watching this whole renminbi / yuan of China's, and realizing that, you know, right now it's bumping up against very key levels to the downside. A lot of guys a lot smarter than me have made the assertion that it's going to be a key thing to watch, and that if China is forced to devalue substantially, that it will send a massive wave of economic strife through the globe. Is that your take? And if it is, can you explain the mechanics of why that would be so devastating, a big Chinese devaluation?
I do think that there, you know, you have to certainly assign, you know, the way I like to look at it, Zach, is to not force myself to say, okay, do you think this is going to happen or not going to happen, and figure out what the right probability is, right? Because there is some probability of not, there is some non-zero probability of China yuan devaluation, right? So right. We have to consider what could happen when that happens. So if you say that we are going to devalue the yuan and it starts blasting through 7 per dollar toward 8 or 9 or something like that, what happens then is you have a big game of capital flight, right? So the first thing that you'll see is you'll see money come out of all of the, you know, China and neighboring economies. You'll see, you know, the China yuan weaken dramatically. You'll see the Aussie dollar weaken dramatically. You'll see their stock markets weaken dramatically alongside that, as money comes out of those centers due to the risk of a severe economic downturn.
Gotcha.
So that's basically the start of what happens. You know, instead of there, if you picture it being a run on a bank where all of a sudden depositors want to pull their money out, that would be a little bit like a run on a country.
Right, right. And then that
where investors, yeah, want to pull their money out. Then you see, you know, that's obviously, those are the moves. Those are the transactions that are moving the yuan market, right? It's not just a disco ball out there, right? People are trading yuan for dollar on this price, and that's why it's moving so far. So the reason, you know, the reason it's moving so far is because they're pulling the capital out rather than this is causing the other. So that's an important way to look at it, because when you have money pulling out of currency markets, out of bond markets and equity markets, and then out of the currency market, you've got a lot of cross-border action going on. And that's what, you know, sort of wakes up markets and spikes volatility, if that's fair to say.
Yeah, no, and it's fascinating stuff. So in that vein, and again, without trying to make extrapolations of what's going to go on in the future, because, I think there's a lot of from my perspective and the chair I'm sitting in, I think there's a lot of concerning things out there, a lot of concerning economic numbers. Certainly the trajectory right now is in the wrong direction. Yet at the same time, especially here in the U.S., well, mainly here in the U.S., I was having this discussion with our analyst just yesterday. I said, And he and I were agreeing on this, but hey, yeah, things are not headed in the right direction. But a lot of these indicators we've looked at have been, you know, materially worse at different points along this expansion, and we didn't end up going into recession. So, you know, taking everything with a grain of salt, I think predicting where we are economically over the next 12 months is one of the toughest things. You know, that to me just feels like it's almost impossible to handicap, which is why I completely agree with your take. We play it the way we see it. But with that in mind, what are you focused on right now? What are the things that, you know, if you had your bullet point to tell investors, look, these are how we see, or these are the things that we've identified is what we are focused on right now. These are the hinges. What are those?
Right now, I'm wildly focused on the dynamic where this rally in the bond markets, and especially in Europe, is causing an expansion of the pool of negative yielding bonds.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that, can we cover that territory here?
Oh, 100%.
It's a little bit complicated, right? But we've seen German yields go from, you know, sort of call it 10-year yields, go from plus 50 basis points to minus 50 basis points, where you're now paying Germany to hold your money, right?
Yeah.
Totally different dynamic. Completely insane dynamic. I mean, we have left the building, right? Like, this is in Never Never Land. So
yeah.
We have to figure out what this is going to mean to the market. But what the biggest thing that I'm following this for is because of my metals trading background, we know that a metals length in gold or silver, which you do not have to pay interest on, you only have to pay storage on, is a better investment than one that you have to pay interest on.
Mm.
Right. So what happens then is you have money rushing into precious metals when that pool of negative yielding securities expands due to the ferocious bond rallies that are going on in Switzerland and in Germany and in France. So now you've got more and more of these countries' yields going curves going negative yield. And so investors are saying, you know what, I'd rather own gold or silver, and I'll take my chances with the price appreciation, because as a store of value, they're really not that volatile, right, compared to the equity markets, right? They're a low volatility item. So you've got money rushing into precious metals, and I think that that's a massive, massive trade right now to be following. Since the beginning of the global central bank pivot to dovishness, which basically occurred, I would say, the end of May or so, the Bitcoin and gold and silver have woken up and started rallying. So sort of as bond markets rally and that pool of negative yielding securities expands, people buy more and more gold and silver. And I think that there's a massive opportunity for those markets, which have now broken out of technical patterns, to really rally. So that's a big focus of what I'm looking on now as it relates to the global macro trade. The note actually that I wrote this morning was about how moves in the bond market can put you into a metals trade.
Yeah, no, and that's we've been, you know, keeping an eye on gold specifically. Really, since I've been in the industry, I've kind of got that in my background, so I'm always keeping an eye on gold.
Yeah.
You know, not a gold bug, but realizing...
Okay, as per usual, we had to end this interview a little bit early due to time constraints,
But you can go to the our website, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. Just Google it. It'll take you right there. You can also find us at Know Your Risk Radio on Stitcher, and you can hear the remainder of this podcast, and I think you should. It's a valuable listen and a guy with great insights. Anyway, but thanks for listening. Hope you guys have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you again next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.